This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, it's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. My name is Tina Camellia and joining me this week for Health News Digest is...
Soon Heng.
Hello, Soon Heng. How are you doing?
Good, good. Chinese New Year is still around, so, you know, time to enjoy.
Yeah, so today's Health News Digest, the theme of the week, there's not really one. We are kind of having a mixed match of everything under the sun that really caught our attention over the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, some interesting stuff, though.
Some interesting
stuff. Yeah, some you can even laugh at.
Yeah, like deadly epidemic.
No, like music for dogs.
Yes, that's right. That's going to be one of our stories today. The first one, though, is...
Bill Gates predicts next deadly epidemic.
Yep, he appeared at an event in Davos, Switzerland, to discuss the real possibility of a deadly epidemic and the steps we can take to detect and prevent one. He was in Davos to promote his Global Health Security Initiative, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, or CEPI.
When I saw this article that you sent to me, at the same time, I got one of these WhatsApp thing. Mm-hmm. And there was this guy who is called Craig Hamilton Parker from Southampton. He gave his list of predictions for 2017. And one of the things that he's predicted is a major epidemic in 2017. So...
Yeah,
he and Bill Gates are on the same page.
Yeah, and I think a lot of world leaders are as well. Moving on, the second story of the day. Doctors removed patient's lungs to save her life. This happened in Canada in what's believed to be a world first.
I assume in the medical procedures, they're always world's first for this, world's first for that. How important is this from the perspective of somebody who does health and living?
In cases similar to the patients, she was born with cystic fibrosis. And in the past, when someone reaches that stage in their illness, what the doctors do would be discussing end-of-life care.
Because, and this is usually a congenital problem?
It's a genetic.
Yeah, it's genetic. Therefore, I assume it's from birth. And therefore, yeah, they don't have a long lifespan.
Yeah. And then moving on, we will talk about fat cops. Overweight and obese policemen with the Iskandar Puteri Police District in Johor will have 6 months from now to shed their extra weight.
You know, in the States, it's always the joke about the policeman and his donuts and coffee, mm-hmm, right? So what's the joke here? Why are our policemen overweight? Nasi lemak and teh tarik.
Possible, or roti canai.
Roti canai.
And finally, the last story of the day, dogs prefer reggae and soft rock music over other genres of music, according to researchers.
Well, music affects human beings' behavior.
Yeah, but this is, I think, one of the first times that they've had proper research to show that it affects dogs' behavior.
My question is, why research on dogs?
I think it's because we all know how dogs are kind of part of our lives. We have dogs as companions and finding...
Something common between us and dogs?
Something in common and how we can enjoy music together now.
Oh, yeah. I always thought like something in common is always men are dogs. So anyway...
I didn't say that. That's all you.
See, I can say that. I'm a man.
All right, that's what's coming up in the next hour. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, it's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. My name is Tina Camellia. In the studio with me this week is Lim Soon Heng.
Hi.
So, our first story of the day, Bill Gates predicts next deadly epidemic. He appeared at the World Economic Forum to discuss the possibility of a deadly epidemic and the steps we can take to detect and prevent one. And he introduced, of course, a new global health security initiative, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, or CEPI.
Well, I think CEPI is a step in the right direction. You know, I think it's too bad in a way that we had to have these epidemics to get us to move. But the timing in terms of the science, the recognition that epidemics don't respect borders. And so whether you're looking at this through a humanitarian lens or a purely domestic lens, these are investments that should be made. I think an epidemic, either naturally caused or intentionally caused, is the most likely thing to cause, say, 10 million excess deaths, and that it's pretty surprising how little preparedness there is for it. Now, it's tricky because this is a global problem, so, you know, how do countries work together? which countries should put up what resources, and every aspect of it, the resources to go engage in the affected countries, the allocation decisions. As we've seen various flu scares come along, we haven't had a super good response. And then Ebola, which, although it was much smaller, there was some luck involved in that. Because it wasn't spread through respiratory contact, the reproductive rate was a lot lower, and it was basically people who were sick or dead who were doing most of the transmission. You know, I think the global health community was a bit surprised because that particular pathogen had been seen in rural settings, and so it never got into large numbers. The fact that it could get into an urban setting and then the reproduction rate would be pretty substantial, that came as a negative surprise.
What's the difference between an epidemic and a pandemic? Because I also read somewhere giving SARS as an epidemic, mm-hmm. when SARS killed 800 people worldwide. I wonder if it's a question of magnitude.
A pandemic, it's a global epidemic. An epidemic could be a little bit
regional,
more regional.
More confined.
Yeah, right. So Bill Gates and his new coalition to prevent epidemics was launched at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. This forum was held 2 weeks ago, and the coalition is backed by the governments of Germany, Japan and Norway, with the support, of course, from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They're committing almost $500 million.
I guess with this concern about epidemics and pandemics, it stems from this thing called superbugs also, right?
Yes, yes. There's an antimicrobial resistance. And we've done so many shows on that every few months just to make sure that it's on at the top of everyone's minds, because part of the reason for it to happen is because of our poor usage of antibiotics and not complying to what the doctors order. What I find surprising is the fact that Bill Gates, being someone who is not from, he doesn't have a healthcare background. He's a software tech giant. But, you know, in the recent years, moved towards healthcare initiatives on a global level and trying to mobilize resources and as well as expertise to find a cure, to find the financial mechanism to make sure that, you know, we can face the next big thing.
Well, at least he has the money to kind of push this thing forward. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, so the initiative was, of course, conceived in response to the recent Ebola outbreak. 2 years ago, he published an article in the New England Journal of Medicine titled The Next Epidemic, Lessons from Ebola, where one of the issues that he brought up was how we were not
prepared
for Ebola. And it was a good thing, as he mentioned just now, that it was
easily contained.
Yeah.
Compared to other potential epidemics.
Yeah. If it's an airborne disease, then, you know, it spreads a lot faster. And
yeah, like SARS. SARS is airborne, isn't it?
Yeah. So he also, as you mentioned just now, raised concerns over antimicrobial resistance to drugs, saying that the success of antibiotics had created complacency.
You can just pop a pill and be okay in the morning.
Yeah.
And so we kind of take our medication without much respect for mm-hmm. what it can and potentially cause.
How are you with medicine?
I try not to take, but I might be doing too much with food supplements maybe. And right now I'm doing ginkgo and fish oil.
That's not too many. So last year, I think our former colleague Lee Chui Lin spoke to a futurist and a biologist about what a post-antibiotic future could be like. And this is what Kit Arrow said.
Ever since we started fighting disease, diseases have tried to get the better of us. Interestingly, talking about antibiotic resistance, there has been evidence found by a group of researchers from McMaster University in Hamilton in Canada. They did some spelunking in caves in Mexico, and they found evidence of antibiotic resistance genes that are 7,000 years old. So antibiotic resistance is certainly not something that's popped up in the last century. It's been around for a long time. So there's been an ongoing fight against bacteria, and we're always going to have to try and stay on top of it. We're always going to have to try and vary our tactics. Nothing's going to work perfectly forever, and nothing's going to work perfectly across all spectrums. Something that works against MRSA may not work against C. diff. So we are kind of going to have to stay on top of fighting it, and medicine is going to have to be active rather than passive, rather than just say, this pill will prevent bacteria from ever harming you. It's going to have to be, this pill will prevent these bacteria from harming you in this case.
What message would you like to leave us with on the subject of a post-antibiotic era or the touted antibiotic apocalypse?
It's not going to be an apocalypse. It's going to be bad, but it's not going to wipe out all life on Earth It's not going to change our lives dramatically. It is going to affect a large number of people. Unfortunately, people are going to die. But society in general is still going to continue as it is. Medical costs will go up, but that's happening regardless. And have hope. There are a number of very smart people out there who are working on some very nifty things, including precious metals, some DNA treatments, and of course, harvesting viruses that fight off bacteria. So we've got some good treatments out there, and this is not the end of the world. We're going to get through this.
He sounds so cheery.
I think that's part of his role as a futurist, to provide some hope when we have some doom and gloom type of story like this.
Well, if you're a futurist, you want to look into the future. And if you got no hope, then there's no future.
Correct. You'll be out of a job. All right. So we'll leave it at that. And when we come back, we'll talk about how doctors removed a patient's lungs to save her life. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. It's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. My name is Tina Camilla. Joining me in the studio today is Lim Soon Heng.
So we'll be talking about this young woman with cystic fibrosis.
That's right. So since we left off on the topic of antibiotic resistance, in the world first, Canadian doctors saved a woman's life with a radical procedure. They removed her lungs, the source of an antibiotic resistant infection.
So when they removed her lungs, what did they do to help her breathe? And one of those iron lung
machines,
things?
Yeah. She was hooked up to a couple of machines to help pump oxygenated blood. So Melissa Benoit, this is the backstory. She was born with cystic fibrosis. It's a genetic disorder. So normally it affects the lungs, but it can also affect the pancreas, liver, kidneys, almost every key organ in your body. And long-term issues include difficulty breathing and coughing up mucus as a result of the frequent lung infections.
How old would these young people live till before the disease overwhelmed them?
20s, 30s, about there.
If that's the case, I was thinking about this when I was reading the article. I remember a fellow dorm mate who had this, and he would ask me, can you help me? So he would like lean with his body hanging over the side of his bed and ask me to tap his back.
Mm-hmm.
And he coughs it out.
So this is what Benoit had to say about her condition.
When you have CF, you cough all the time. I became increasingly short of breath at home, then started needing oxygen 24/7, which was a very big deal for me. I had never had that in my life before. So it was very strange and a little worrisome, thinking like, oh my gosh, is this it? And that was even not enough.
She was admitted into the hospital after a bout of influenza, which left her gasping for air. She had coughing fits. It fractured some of her ribs.
My gosh, you can cough so hard.
Yeah, and then her lungs began to fill up with blood, pus, and mucus. So the doctors, with the help of state-of-the-art technology that oxygenated and circulated her blood, they were able to, you know, she spent almost a week in the ICU without lungs until they could find a suitable organ for the transplantation.
We did take her to the operating room, removed both her lungs. For the first time ever, we had a patient in our intensive care unit with no lungs.
That's Dr. Shaf Keshavji, the Surgeon-in-Chief of University Health Network, who was part of the team.
She also had to have a new kidney or something?
Eventually, yeah. So she's now on dialysis. And once her condition improved, because you need to be in very good shape for that kind of very invasive surgery. I mean, after this lung transplant, her muscles were so deconditioned from having spent so many months in the hospital bed. The good news is that her new lungs are uninfected by the mutated genes, so she doesn't cough like she used to. But her kidney did fail from sepsis because of the initial infection.
So does that mean then people who are suffering from cystic fibrosis
should just
if they get new lungs, then there is hope?
I think this is why this is such a huge news in Canada and, of course, throughout the world, because, you know, it's a world first and we never know. Maybe this is the treatment. It's very invasive, though, because you're replacing organs in your body and you're going to be on drugs for the rest of your life. I mean, not that you're not already on drugs if you have such a debilitating condition.
Are you an organ donor?
I pledge to donate my organs. I'm a card-carrying organ donor pledger.
We should make a plug for organ donation.
Yeah.
People go shine a card.
That's right. I agree. Are you an organ donor?
Yes.
Very good.
Not that anybody would want my organs.
You never know. You're a very healthy man. All right. So that's all for that story. We're going to talk about
healthy men.
Healthy men, hopefully. So, healthy men. Not trying to make light of Benoit's situation, but speaking of huffing and puffing. Overweight and obese policemen with the Iskandar Puteri Police District in Johor have about 6 months from now to shed their extra weight.
But you know, this is not a problem just amongst our uniformed men here in Malaysia. You hear this all over the world, you know, like, you know, policemen being overweight and they are put on a regimen to kind of get their weight down and under control.
I wonder why that happened, because if you were to be recruited as a policeman, you'd have to pass a fitness test. So they definitely started off being really healthy, fit individuals, and then...
And they probably were. But, you know, nowadays our jobs are also sedentary, which, you know, policemen sitting now filling out reports, they ride on motorbikes or something, you know, motorized in a car. In Malaysia, we don't see policemen on the beat, walking the sidewalks.
Yeah, so that's
get
probably...
Get them on bicycles.
Yeah, actually, that's a good idea. But this isn't the first time we've heard of initiatives like this. In fact, around this time last year, the police launched the Trim and Fit program for cops with a BMI above 25. Bukit Aman's Director of Management Communications, Dato' Zulkifli Abdullah, said that at least 10% of the police force are obese. So 1 in 10.
I think they should start with the guys at the top. Are they themselves fit?
That's a good question, yeah. Essentially, the concern is that they're more likely to die from health problems than they are in the line of duty.
Too much sugar. In fact, I was reading an article that came out through the local consumer report, said that we are the 8th highest consumers of sugar in the world. Highest in Asia, so.
And because of the news... When the first time it broke last year, I invited Teo Joyin, an occupational therapist with a focus on obesity management and corporate health, to explain exactly how obesity affects work performance.
Because obesity is a gateway health condition. So usually people who are obese would then have other complementary health conditions, high blood pressure, diabetes. My clients actually find these chronic diseases that develop along with obesity very disruptive. It means taking sick leave, and when you're on sick leave and you're spending a lot of time in the waiting rooms, you're not at work, and of course that would impede your work performance. You can't perform if you're not at work in the first place. Mm-hmm. There are some professions such as oil and gas offshore workers who can actually get fired if their BMI exceeds a certain the limit as stipulated by their safety regulations, obviously because it would impede their work performance and also their own personal safety when they're offshore. So yes, obesity can have a huge impact on a person's work performance.
Yeah, I mean, actually, this is an issue, I think, across Malaysia. It's not just confined to the uniformed policemen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You go walk down the street, we're getting to see. In fact, they say kids are getting overweight.
A lot earlier, yeah.
So. Soda, TV, couch.
So this time around, the cops in the Johor district are being singled out by the OCPD superintendent, Noor Hisham Muhammad, who said that out of 600 policemen within the police district, 20% of them were categorized as obese and 50% were overweight. So only 3 in 10 policemen
are fit,
in this district. And most of them were above 30 years of age. Most also have been in the service for at least 5 years. So I think it's the job that...
I mean, 21st century lifestyle is sedentary, period.
Mm-hmm. Starting from 2018, those who fail to maintain an ideal weight and BMI will not be considered for promotion as directed by Bukit Aman. I think that's fair. Because it's a job requirement to be fit and to be able to chase down a thief.
Thugs.
Yeah.
Snatch thieves.
Yeah.
Chase.
But, you know, for if you're overweight or severely obese, exercising would be very different compared to, let's say, people like you and I who are a little bit more fit, or we exercise.
Yeah, you're under 30, so it makes it quite easy.
And you exercise on a daily basis. So
I try to, yeah.
Yeah, so your kind of exercise regimen is very different from these people who are going to be embarking on this, you know, weight loss journey. Personal trainer Karen Sia, whom we've had last year, she spoke about exercising for the obese and how that's slightly different.
I think a very common misconception that people have of overweight people is that they're lazy. I know a lot of people who actually work very hard, and because there's some medical reason or because of certain circumstances, that they find it very difficult to lose that weight. But they are nowhere near lazy. I've met many other people who are slimmer, who are way lazier than the obese people that I've met. When people just say, oh, look at this person, why can't you just get off the couch and just go outside and do some activity? It's not that simple. They have to consider a lot of things. If they have not been exercising for the past 5 to 10 years due to whatever reason, then the stress on their joints and the stress, or they probably already have injuries or pain that they don't know how to deal with. So these are things that we need to be made known to the person that's prescribing the exercise, or the person that's going to train with them. It could just be a friend or a spouse or something. These things need to be checked by a doctor or by a physiotherapist to see if it's actually feasible for them to just go out and run.
What are the common health risks and considerations that obese or overweight clients might have?
Most of the time it's pain in their knees, pain in their ankles. I know a lot of overweight people who surprisingly have very small feet, and the feet definitely cannot take the weight of their body. So they have ankle issues. The fact that they're overweight makes them walk in a way that is not helpful or not friendly to their knees. So yeah, these are some of the very common things. And also certain movements without realizing, I guess, something as simple as a sit-up or a crunch. For someone who has a very big waist, it's actually very difficult for them to go into a crunch. These are things that you need to consider when you want to prescribe exercises to overweight or obese people.
Well, the focus here definitely is on the cure. I think maybe somebody like the military, the all these uniformed service providers, they need to take care of themselves right at the start. Because when they went in, they made the grade, which means then their weights were appropriate. They can do all those things. It's over the 5 years that they've been in the service that they slowly lose the condition that they're supposed to maintain. So the thing to do is to have a program that is part of their daily activities.
Every morning march.
When I was at going to school, one of the PE courses that we had to take, the very first one, was titled Fitness for Life.
Mm-hmm.
That made an impression on me, you know, and that's why maybe it's kind of put a little fire under me and kept me going and have a little regimen and be disciplined about it.
I just like it because I like being able to move about and not be a cause of nuisance for other people, you know? That's just me. And that's our third story of the day. And when we come back, we will cover our last story about dogs and music. Sounds fun and exciting.
It is.
Yeah, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. It's Health and Living on The Big Picture. My name is Tina Carmelia, and in the studio with me, Lim Soon Heng.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello. You're stretching out in the studio and dancing, bobbing your body.
Yeah, I love that music, though. Yeah. I mean, who doesn't like a reggae music?
Yeah, so maybe one way for the obese cops to shed the weight is by dancing to
I'm
music.
I'm not going near that.
I mean, it's true. And, you know, who better to do that with than your pets, or in the case of the police force, probably the canine unit? Because dogs appear to prefer reggae and soft rock over other genres of music, according to a new research. The Scottish SPCA and the University of Glasgow have published a paper which suggests music affects dogs' behavior. I don't think that that's surprising to many dog lovers. I'm sure that it's just a confirmation of what they already know.
You know, a few years ago, at the University of Leicester, some researchers played classical music to dairy cows, and the cows produce more milk. And this was not just published in magazines or journals, but even amongst this kind of forum for farmers, dairy farmers. So obviously there is some truth. I mean, for me, I think there is a lot of truth about what music does to us.
I wonder, do you have any pets?
Used to. Now that I live in a condominium, we are not allowed to. And my lifestyle doesn't allow for a pet. I struggle to keep plants alive.
Well, I've had pets throughout my life until I left home. My pets didn't seem to enjoy music at all. They just don't care for it.
Maybe they didn't care for your music.
I listen to reggae. I listen to soft rock.
But, you know, in the article, too, said, well, you know, dogs like music, but some of them have preferences. You know, so it's not just like play reggae and all dogs will like reggae.
Most dogs will like reggae. The rest probably just soft
your
rock.
Dog didn't.
So, well, the researchers, they played a variety of music to dogs at a rehoming center and assessed physiological and behavioral changes. And the most positive behavior changes were seen when the dogs were played reggae. But the study showed that each dog had its own music tastes, and it could range from Motown to pop to classical.
In fact, music therapy is something that is slowly coming into Malaysia, even because I know of somebody from the UK who came over here and he's asking, what are you doing here? He says, I'm providing music therapy. I know of people who are doing theater therapy mostly with kids on the autism spectrum. We just don't have enough experts to go around to the hospitals, to homes for the aged, to deal with the issues that these different groups are facing and using music as a therapy. I know of a young woman who sings, and she says she's using her songs as therapy, as a mode of healing.
Not too long ago, maybe last year or the year before that, we had Rhea Thomas from Angsana Care, where they provide art therapy for palliative care for children. And I think that that's just one of the very few initiatives in Malaysia when it comes to using art as a form of therapy, not just music, but, you know, like you said, theater and all that, painting.
Well, I went to the American Music Therapy Association site. They had a list of music therapy for the different issues. For literary populations, autism spectrum, we all know that, Alzheimer's. For people in correctional facilities, in medicine, in pain management, and then, of course, for young children. And I think this was many years ago, we were talking to women who are pregnant, that to play classical music to your baby by holding the speakers close to your abdomen.
In last month's Health News Digest, that's theme around music and sound, we did cover a little bit more on the role of music to your health and well-being. So if you missed that, you can always check out the podcast.
Yeah. You know, with WhatsApp, you get all these videos coming from different directions. And this was one that came from a friend of mine about a university professor in economics who graduated from Harvard but is in Israel. And his name is Rafi Eldor. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's. And somehow, I don't know how, he went into dancing. And now that is his therapy. His motor skills are better.
There you go.
The arts.
Coming from the front row producer, completely unbiased.
Unbiased.
Yeah, completely impartial. Of course, you know what that means. We are leading out with music from perhaps the most well-known reggae artist of all times, Bob Marley. Here's Everything's Gonna Be All Right. I think that's apt.
Yeah.
BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.